Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by USU Huntsman School of Business, Partners in Business, 38th Annual Operational Excellence Conference and the Echoes Conference Center, October 3rd and 4th, including keynote speaker Hiram Smith, Chairman and CEO Legacy Quest Incorporated, co-founder and former CEO Franklin Covey. Details at partners.usu.edu.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our guest this hour, Hiram Smith, says that he grew up with the mindset that you get a college degree, get into a big corporation, grow in a big corporation. So I did that, he says. What I discovered when I got to identifying my governing values was the thing I really wanted to do was to teach. And so Hiram Smith, with just a couple of others, founded a company in his basement, went on, of course, we all know, to found Franklin Quest. He's the creator of the Franklin Day Planner and write best-selling books like The 10 Natural Laws of Successful Time and Life Management and What Matters Most. And he says, in What Matters Most, in the rush and press of modern life, too many have lost contact with the deeply held values that matter. Hiram Smith will give the keynote address on Wednesday, tomorrow, at the USU Huntsman School of Business Partners in Business, 38th Annual Operational Excellence Conference at USU. He's my guest for most of the hour today. Later in the program, we'll be talking with Utah State University President Stan Albrecht. The conclusion is coming up to a very successful, the first in USU's history, a comprehensive fundraising campaign. We'll be talking about that as we go along. Hiram Smith, welcome to Access Utah.
Hey, thank you. It's great to be here.
We appreciate you coming back on the program. We talked a few years ago in our downtown studios, I recall.
That's right. You have a good memory. Yes. It was a few years ago.
First of all, I want to get your comments on the recent passing of your colleague, Stephen R. Covey.
Well, that was a real tragedy. Steve's a dear friend. You know, it's interesting. I met Steve Covey in England in 1963. And he was a mission president for the Mormon Church in Ireland, and I was a missionary in London. And that's where we first met, and we've been good friends ever since. And, you know, in 1997, we put our companies together. That's when we became Franklin Covey, and just had a lot of fun together, you know, changing people's lives. That's what we were about. But, you know, Steve had been ill for a while, but he, you know, he got on a bicycle. I don't know if you know, but he had a bicycle accident. He fell from his bike and hit his head, and the complications from that injury is what killed him, and it was just a real tragedy.
Parenthetically, I was curious about how that merger went. It seemed to be amicable and worked very well.
You know, it did go well. It wasn't an easy merger. There are two very different cultures, but we were able to get by the corporate cultural differences, and it became a really wonderful thing. I mean, we were teaching time management, and he was teaching leadership, and the thing that put us together really was we had many common clients like DuPont and Procter & Gamble and General Motors, and these companies would say, hey, you know, you guys are only 40 miles apart, you know, why don't you guys get together, then we can send our bill to only one place. And it was interesting. I ran into Steve at the funeral of Rex Lee, the former president of BYU, who is also a dear friend. And I said, Steve, you know, we're getting a lot of pressure from our clients to put our companies together. What do you think? And he says, well, maybe we ought to talk about it. And that's how it started. Mm. And, you know, then over a period of time, we made the decision to do it, put the companies together, and it's turned out to be a wonderful thing.
Is it a coincidence, do you think, that maybe the two, you know, top coaches on time and life management happen to be sort of boys with Utah ties, members of the same church? Is there something in that?
You know, a lot of people have asked me that, and the fact is our backgrounds are very similar because of the ties that we have with our church, and the whole idea of ordering one's life around what really matters most to us is something that Steve and I grew up with. And if you really take a close look at what Steve taught through his Seven Habits concept and what we taught through our time management thing, was really, you know, what we had grown up with put into corporate language. And I think the reason that resonated with so well is because the human being really does want to have what I call inner peace. They want their lives to be okay. They want to be valuable. They want to make a difference. And all we did was build on that and say, you know what? We believe that what the quest, and that's why we call their company Quest, Franklin Quest, the quest that everybody on the planet has is to achieve a oneness between what I do and what I value. Because only when what I do and what I value line up do I have a right to inner peace. For example, if I have a value to be physically fit and I weigh 400 pounds, there is a huge gap between what I value and what I'm doing. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
And the only way I can get inner peace on that value is to change what I'm doing. I've got to bring what I do in line with what I value. So I've got to exercise, cut down on fat and stuff, you know, do what I have to do. And the minute that weight starts to come in line, I have this overpowering sense of inner peace. If I value being financially okay and I'm $600,000 in debt, there's a huge gap between what I'm doing and what I value. I've got to get, you know, I've got to close that gap. And so really what we were all about was teaching people to close the gap. And you know, I've had hundreds of people over the years say, you know, you guys aren't teaching time management, you're teaching life management. Why don't you admit that? And I said, well, fact is, we really are teaching life management, but if that's what we told people, nobody'd come. So our Trojan horse is time management, and when people come to our seminars, then they realize, holy cow, this is a whole lot more than time management. This is how to get my life in order, you know.
you're tricking people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, they have a good time doing it. I'm interested in your experience closing that gap. You had a successful career at ADP as a sales manager, found out you're good at sales, but at some point you started looking at your core values. How did that happen?
Well, it was really interesting. I did have a, you know, I was drafted, to go a little farther, I got drafted during the Vietnam War, and so I ended up spending 4.5 years in uniform. Ended up in Germany commanding a Pershing missile unit. It was part of the Cold War over there, so I never got into the Hot War, but had lost quite a few friends in the Hot War. And when I came back from that experience, you know, I finished my formal education at Brigham Young University and discovered I could sell things and started on what turned out to be a very successful sales career, first in insurance and then in computers with ADP out of New York. And when I was 34 years old, out of the blue, I get a phone call from my church wanting to know if I would be a mission president in California. So I did that, and I went to California and spent 3 years. And while I was there, I discovered a passion for teaching. And, you know, I averaged like 8 or 9 speeches a week for 156 weeks and discovered that, not only did I love that, but I felt like I was good at it. So when I got through with that experience in 1981, what I really wanted to do was teach. And ADP offered me a wonderful job back in New York. The pay was unbelievable, you know, and at that point, and it was very tempting, but I did not want to live in New York, and B, I really did want to teach. And so that's when I decided, well, you know, I'm going to give this a shot. So we started a little first, the name of the first company was H.W. Smith & Associates. I really like that name, but, you know, it didn't work. So the next year, we decided to call it Franklin because we had decided to do time management. There was a recession going on, and a friend of mine that had worked with me at ADP was working with me. He lived in Oregon, and I was living here in Utah. And so we decided that we were going to teach time management. And so, I became enamored with Ben Franklin's life and how he managed his life. And so we used him as a template, as the core of our seminar, because he identified his governing values and ordered his life around his governing values. He called them his 13 virtues. And you know, in my opinion, Ben Franklin is probably one of the most productive Americans ever. I mean, what he accomplished in his lifetime is unbelievable. So we started this little company in my basement, and, you know, Dick Winwood, who was up in Oregon, and we just created this little seminar, and we started selling it, and it exploded around us. We were absolutely stunned at how this, what we taught, resonated with people, because we went in and literally said, if you want peace in your life, this is what you've got to do. You've got to write your own personal constitution. And people were quite stunned by that, you know, and we used the example, you know, this country is built on a constitution. And people decided that, you know, if we're going to, you know, what would we fight for? What would we go to battle for? Why did we fight the revolution? We fought the revolution so that we could determine our own destiny. We could decide what we wanted to do without anybody else, you know, telling us what to do. And so we wrote this constitution, and that constitution is used to validate every law that we ever make. Every law has to be in line with that constitution. And so what we taught was, what you do, the events of your life, have to line up with what you value. And if they don't, you're going to be in pain. If there's a gap between what you're doing and what you value, you're going to be in pain. And why live in pain? And then we gave them a simple step, and we've created the Franklin Planner as a tool so that they could close that gap. And it was just exciting to see how people became almost obsessed with their Franklin Planner, because this is the tool that is bringing peace into my life. And, you know, we went from my garage in Centerville, Utah, to 4,000 people, you know, $600 million corporation. You know, we were sending day planners to 170 countries. I mean, it was an unbelievable run.
And I was one of those. I had the Franklin Planner. It seemed like everybody I knew at that time had the Franklin Planner. I'm going to ask you a bit about how you get to your core values, and that's, of course, the core of this. If you just joined us, we're talking with Hiram Smith. He's co-founder of Franklin Quest, chairman and CEO of Legacy Quest, right now co-founder and former CEO of Franklin Covey. And he'll be giving a keynote address tomorrow morning at the USU Huntsman School of Business Partners in Business 38th Annual Operational Excellence Conference. That's at the Eccles Conference Center, and it's happening Wednesday and Thursday, the conference is. Details at partners.usu.edu. You ask and answer the question in your book, The 10 Natural Laws of Successful Time and Life Management. Why do people come to your seminars and buy your books? I'll ask you that question.
Well, the biggest reason that people come is because they've someone that they've known, we call it the breeder effect, somebody they've known has gone to our seminar, has had an electrifying experience in getting better control of their lives, and then they say to their spouse, their secretary, their partner at work, their friend on the bus, hey, listen, I just went to a seminar, it blew me away, you've got to do this. And you know, 2-3 years into our growth, that's why people were coming, because they'd heard that this was an unbelievable experience. I tell you, when we got into Dow Chemical, this is a great story. It will really answer your question. We did one seminar in Dow Chemical up in Midland, Michigan, in 1984. And after that seminar, we trained 32,000 people in Dow Chemical, and they had a waiting list of 800 people to go to that seminar. And Dow Chemical would not allow anyone there to have a day planner until they had gone through the training. So I lived in Michigan for several years, and I ended up going all over the world for Dow Chemical, you know, to Japan, to China, to Europe. I mean, it was just an unbelievable thing. And the Franklin Planner became like a religious cult at Dow Chemical. They used to salute each other with their day planners. And if you came to a meeting at Dow Chemical without your day planner, you were exorcised from the meeting. You know, it was really fun. But the reason they came is because somebody had told them, you know, this thing has changed my life. You got to check this out.
Of course, the impulse a lot of people have is to get organized, but there's a deeper impulse, isn't there? It's that inner peace that you were talking about, to actually be doing the things that really matter to you. And I wonder I wonder if you could tell me, first of all, about the I-beam, a visual exercise that you have people do.
Well, you know, that experience, the I-beam experience, I've done it literally hundreds of times in seminars and speeches that I've done, and it's a very electric moment in the learning experience. Is what I use that story to illustrate how powerful governing values are. And what I do is, you know, I select somebody in the room. We're at the point in the seminar where we're talking about writing your own personal, you know, identifying your governing values. And how do I know what my governing values are? And so I find somebody in the room. I say, now, I need somebody in the room to help me that has a child under the age of 2. Anybody qualify? Invariably, you know, somebody will raise their hand. I prefer a man, quite frankly, to do it because, you know, women tend to be more emotional. But I want a man to be emotional. Men don't like to show their emotions, and women are much more willing to show their emotions. So I pick a man, usually, if I've got one. And he'll say, yeah. I say, what's the child's name? Joseph. Okay. Now I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. Just respond as you feel appropriate. And I say, I have an I-beam out here in front of the hotel, and it's 300 feet long. And I said, I'm going to put you at one end of the I-beam. I'm going to get the other end. We're going to let everybody in the room here get line up on both sides just to see what you do. And I say, and then I take a $100 bill out of my wallet, and I say, I raise my $100 bill, and I say, look, if you'll come across this I-beam without stepping off either side, get here in 2 minutes, I'll give you $100. Would you come? Well, of course, yeah, I'll come. Okay. Well, now we're going to change the scenario. We're going to take this same I-beam and take it down to the Grand Canyon. There's a place there, 300 feet across, 1,100 feet straight down. We're going to bolt it into the side of the canyon. You're on one side of the canyon, I'm on the other side. And now I raise my $100, and I say, if you'll come across this I-beam without stepping off either side, get here in 2 minutes, I'll give you $100. Would you come? No way. I said, well, okay, now I have $50,000. Would you come for 50? No way. Now I have $1,000,000. Would you come for $1,000,000? Well, then they hesitate, and I say, now it's raining, and the wind's blowing about 50 miles an hour. Are you going to come? No way. And I said, okay, let's change it one more time. I'm not a nice guy anymore. I have your 2-year-old son over the edge by the hair on my side. And I say to you, if you don't get across that I-beam right now, I'm going to drop your son. And invariably, would you come now? Absolutely, and I'll kill you when I get there. And I said, well, we've just discovered one of your governing values. And that governing value is, I love my child. You know, money has value, safety has value. But of a greater value is the love of the child. You would probably risk the I-beam for the child. That is what governing values are really all about. And then I need to lighten it up. I say, you know, I did this once with a woman that had a teenager, and they will not come across for a teenager. and that's a true story. It happened in San Diego. But then I asked this question. I said, I want you to write this question in your notes. What would you cross the I-beam for? And I got to tell you, the impact of that on people has been unbelievable. And people, for the first time, start asking the question, well, what would I cross that I-beam for? What is so valuable to me, you know, that I would risk, that I would dedicate, which is tougher than risky, but that I would dedicate my life to? What is so valuable to me? And then people start getting, then all of a sudden the value of the Franklin Planner triples and quadruples, because now I sit down and I say, well, you know, my family has value. My job clearly has value. My children have value. My health has value. My integrity has value. And they start, you know, identifying this stuff that really matters to them. And then they've created the base of this thing we call the productivity pyramid. Well, once I have my governing values and I've written that constitution, because we encourage them to write a statement describing what that value means, the minute they do that, you know, it becomes like a shield. Now all of a sudden I have a shield that I can say no. Because when people bombard me wanting me to do all this stuff and it doesn't line up with my shield, my constitution, my governing values, I can say no now. And I can say no because I have a reason why I'm saying no. And it's like the, you know, when it, the guy that, you know, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the boss says, hey, we got a client in town, we got to take him to dinner, you know, sorry, but, you know, you got to come to work tonight. And the guy says, hey, I got to promise my son I'd take him to a ball game tonight. Hey, listen, you got to be at that dinner. Well, wait a second. I'm taking my son to dinner. And the courage to go and take your son to dinner at the risk of maybe losing your job is unbelievable. You would never do that if he hadn't taken the time to write his governing values. One of his governing values was to do something with his son. Am I making sense?
Yes, definitely. We're talking with Hiram Smith on the program today. Later in the program, USU President Stan Albrecht talking about USU's first comprehensive fundraising campaign. It'll have a successful conclusion next week. Hiram Smith for another 20 minutes or so, and you're welcome to join this conversation at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or you can email us at upraxcess@gmail.com, upraxcess@gmail.com. More with Hiram Smith, the co-founder of Franklin Quest, following this.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by Square One Printing in Logan, with personalized printing for home or business, including wedding announcements, thank you cards, family history labels, and notepads. Information is at squareoneprinting.com.
Regional correspondents on Utah Public Radio provide that unique link that makes UPR statewide news coverage your favorite resource for news. Hi, I'm Mackenzie Hamilton. Join me each evening during All Things Considered at 5:30 for expanded Utah news. UPR has a one-of-a-kind network with reporters from Southern Utah, the Uinta Basin, Moab, and Utah County. It's the only way of providing you with the views and news that you need to make informed decisions. Utah Public Radio, your favorite public radio station for statewide Utah news.
Support for Utah Public Radio is also provided by USU Huntsman School of Business, Partners in Business, the 38th Annual Operational Excellence Conference at Ellen Eccles Conference Center, October 3rd and 4th, including keynote speaker Dustin Ott, Global Manager Operational Excellence, Bart Longyear. Details at partners.usu.edu.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're spending most of this hour with Hiram Smith. Of course, we know him as co-founder of Franklin Quest, later CEO of Franklin Covey, author of several best-selling books, including The 10 Natural Laws of Successful Time and Life Management and What Matters Most. He says, in the rush and press of modern life, too many have lost contact with the deeply held values that matter. I wonder if you'd give us your definition of character, a very interesting definition if you have.
Well, I have to preface that by saying that this is my definition, not a dictionary definition. I had to check it out with Webster, and I'm sort of okay. But the definition is that character is the ability to carry out a worthy decision after the emotion of making that decision has passed.
And so that gets into the next topic I'd like to talk to you about. That is, it's a very difficult thing for most people, I would imagine. You get your constitution, you get in touch with your core values, but then you have to get up every day and try to bridge that gap.
Absolutely. And that's the key. You know, what am I going to do about it today? You know, sitting at the top of this productivity pyramid that we taught for so many years, you know, you've got your governing values, then your long-range goals, then your intermediate goals, and then today, what am I going to do about it today? So if you take it like the physically fit thing, I value being physically fit. That's not a goal. That's just something it's important. So what would be a long-range goal? By November 31st, 2012, I'm going to lose 10 pounds. Okay, so that's my goal. What's the intermediate goal? Well, I've got to run, you know, a couple miles each day. I've got to, you know, cut down on the French fries and whatever. So what am I going to bring in my daily task list today that reflects that goal? Well, I'm going to put in my daily task list today, run 2 miles. And when I get a check in my daily task list for running 2 miles, the unbelievable sense of wellness I get just for getting that victory check, that's a victory check, I call them victory check, because I did something that related to one of my Constitution items. And that's, I get a whole bigger rush getting a check for that than I do getting a check for taking out the garbage. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because I've just done something that really mattered to me. And the reason the planner became so popular is because it helps people monitor and manage the commitments that they had made to themselves. And that, you know, one of the things we encourage people to do is, you know, make an appointment with yourself every day, you know, between 2 and 4. Just write in your planner, you know, meeting with self. And then somebody calls and says, hey, can I see you at 2:15? You look at your planner, gee, I'm sorry, I have a meeting, I can't do it. You don't have to tell them meetings with yourself. You just say, hey, listen, that's sacred time for me. And then that's the time I'm going to get stuff done, and I'm not going to be bothered. And, you know, maybe that's when I do my email and stuff. I'll tell you, the digital age has forced everybody into this reactive mode. And the minute you let your life become totally reactive instead of proactive, you're a mess. You're out of control. You're unhappy. You know, marriages fall apart, quite frankly. And the whole idea of being able to say, no, wait a second, you know, I'm not going to do it. When that thing says, hey, you've got mail, okay, fine, I'll wait. I don't have to do it now. I'm going to wait till it's time for me to take care of the email.
And I was going to ask you, I think you partially answered it here, but do you think that the technology, the explosion of technology, has made living these principles easier or harder?
I think the advent of technology is just, well, let me back up. The basic principles, and I make this, in fact, tomorrow when I speak up there, I will make this point. The basic principles that help the human being become more productive and effective have not changed for 6,000 years. The only thing that's changed is the tools with which we implement these principles. And the reason I make that point is because, you know, what has not changed in the last 1,000 years? The human being. Human beings are still the same. We still put our pants on one leg at a time. We got to go to the bathroom 2-3 times a day. The human being's the same. So the principles that help me become a better human being haven't changed for a very long time. But look at all the tools that now to help us. And so the digital age has ramped things up. It makes things go a lot faster. And because we do stuff so much faster, the issue of choice is more important today than ever in our history because I have so many options. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm being bombarded, and so it's a two-edged sword, technology. I can get stuff done faster, but because I can get stuff done faster, I'm expected to do more stuff. And so the treadmill keeps going faster and faster and faster. And if I'm going to slow down that treadmill, or even get off that treadmill, I've got to learn to make choices that I'm going to do what matters most to me, and I am not going to let the noise of the world govern my life. And that's a very courageous thing to do, but only then can I have a right to this thing we call inner peace, when I take control. So the digital, you know, I had an interesting experience. I had a guy call me the other day, and he said, you know, I've switched from my Franklin planner to, I'm now using an iPhone. And he said, I felt like I needed to go to my church leaders and repent. He felt like he'd done something awful because he'd finally gotten rid of his paper planner, you know. But the fact is, if your digital device will let you do everything you could do in your Franklin planner faster and better, then why not? It's just a different tool to get the same thing done. But we have to understand that we're going back to the same principles. The principle of, for example, of physical wellness, okay, that goes back thousands of years. Well, how am I going to keep myself physically well, physically fit? Now, if I can get a digital device to help me do that, great. If I can get a paper planner to help me do that, great. So it's not that the device isn't as important as the basic principles that are driving me to use that device. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. Talking with Hiram Smith, this part of the program, later on we'll have USU President Stan Albrecht talking about USU's first comprehensive fundraising campaign, successfully completes next week. Hiram Smith will give the keynote address tomorrow at the USU Huntsman School of Business Partners in Business 38th Annual Operational Excellence Conference. That's at the Eccles Conference Center on the USU campus, and it runs Wednesday and Thursday. Details at partners.usu.edu. Hiram Smith, of course, chairman and CEO of Legacy Quest, co-founder and former CEO of Franklin Covey, and author of several books, including What Matters Most and the 10 Natural Laws of Successful Time and Life Management. I wonder if I could have you talk a little bit about the leadership. I've been reading something on, this is the Leader Network, I think. LeaderNetwork.org, a little interview with you, and you've responded to some questions that they have. And recall, you're a Civil War buff.
I am.
And you have a very interesting lesson on leadership from the from Gettysburg.
Yeah, it's, of course, for me, Civil War battlefields are sacred ground. In fact, just about 2 months ago, I took one of my granddaughters, my wife and I did, back to Virginia. I have a daughter living in Virginia, and we spent a full day at Gettysburg. And this, my little granddaughter's 13 years old. She'd never been there, had no idea what Gettysburg was. And I've been there so many times, I was able to take her on the tour myself. But the leadership, good and bad leadership that took place at Gettysburg, there are marvelous, marvelous lessons there. And General Lee deciding to send General Pickett across that open field on the third day of the battle was suicide. And his General Longstreet knew it, and Longstreet tried to talk him out of it and said, "This is crazy." And he said, "Hey, we're here, the enemy's there, we're going to do it." They knew the enemy had the high ground, and he sent 15,000 soldiers out across that open field. And 12,000 of them were killed. It was a slaughter. It was unbelievable. 7,000 horses died in that battle, by the way. 53,000 Americans died in that three-day battle. Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, who was one of my heroes, was a colonel from Maine, and he held Little Round Top. And if he hadn't held Little Round Top at Gettysburg, the South would have gotten in behind them, and the battle would have been different. And, you know, Gettysburg changed the course of the war. You know, because the North won that battle, from then on, there are more battles, but that was the turning point in the war.
Hmm. And you write here that Colonel Chamberlain, the key was he went with his men. He was with his people.
Oh, yeah.
People have to know that you're with them.
Yeah, he didn't lead from behind. He was right. And it's a gripping story because his order was very simple. His commander said, "You keep that hill. Whatever it takes, you keep that hill." And he had 350 men in his little battalion, and he held the southernmost tip of the northern line, the Army of the Potomac's line. Longstreet's men, 2,000 of them, charged up that hill five times. And they were repelled four times, okay? And he lost half his men. He was down to 150 men. And when Longstreet sent the wave up the last time of about 1,100 men, Chamberlain was out of bullets. He had no more bullets. And so he had to make a decision. You know, the prudent thing to do would have been to retreat, go back and get some more ammunition, come back, fight another day. But his order was simple. You hold the hill. And so he said, "Fix bayonets, guys. We're charging." And his men looked at him, "You lost your mind. We're going to charge 1,100 guys with no bullets down this hill?" So they did. They fixed bayonets. I get goosebumps thinking about it now. So they fixed bayonets, and as the charge came up the hill, and I've stood on a Little Round Top, and you know, it's hard to imagine. These 150 guys jumped out from their rocks, started yelling and screaming and charging down the hill, and what happened was the Southern troops panicked, and they turned and ran, and they took 800 prisoners with no bullets in their guns. Mm. It's just an amazing story, and he held the hill. He did his job.
By the way, we're talking with Hiram Smith. If you've just joined us, and you can join this conversation by email at upraxis@gmail.com. In What Matters Most, I was intrigued by Chapter 1, that heroes, you say, are people who know what they are. I wonder if you'd explain that to me.
Well, to me, you know, the reason that we encourage people to write that personal constitution is that you finally put down in writing who you are and what matters most to you. And I had an electric experience when I was 19. I was on a mission for my church in London, England, and I had the opportunity of hearing Winston Churchill speak. It was just 2 years before he died. And I sat there at this man's feet who saved the free world, and he was an unbelievable speaker. And he said that he had an obsession his entire life to make a difference. And it was like a baton was passed to me. And I said, you know, that's me. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make a difference. You know, how am I going to do that? You know, And when you write that personal constitution, you, for sometimes for the first time, people realize who they are, because that constitution is a description of who you are. And then your mission statement, and Stephen Covey was big on the mission statement thing, and we were big on the constitution thing, and the thing that made it so powerful of us getting together was that what we were telling people was, write your personal constitution, and now you know who you are. Now you create your mission statement that Stephen Covey will always encourage people to do, and the mission statement is a description of why you're on the planet. And if you know who you are and why you're on the planet, your mission statement, whew, the power that comes with that is unbelievable. And, you know, you get out of those people's way. I mean, they're going to get stuff done. They're going to be somebody.
Well, we are reaching the end of our time here, and Hiram Smith will be presenting the keynote address at the USU Huntsman School of Business Partners in Business 38th Annual Operational Excellence Conference, and that talk is tomorrow morning here on the USU campus. Finally, Hiram Smith, I believe you're living in Gunlock on your ranch, having fun?
Yep.
And I don't know what is next for you. What are you involved in right now?
Well, actually, I've got a fun project right now. I'm writing a book with Spencer Johnson. Spencer Johnson co-authored The 1 Minute Manager. He wrote the book Who Moved My Cheese? And we're writing a book together called The Belief Window. In fact, I'll be talking about that tomorrow in Logan. And it's a fun project. We've been working on it for just over a year. We're getting pretty close to getting it published, and I'm very excited. This is a book that could really, really make a difference.
The Belief Window, that'll be coming out soon,
yep.
I expect. Hiram Smith, we talked about Stephen Covey earlier. Hiram Smith is Chairman and CEO of Legacy Quest, co-founder and former CEO of Franklin Covey. Details on that Operational Excellence Conference are at partners.usu.edu. Hiram Smith, a pleasure as always.
Thank you, sir. It's great to visit with you.
And following a break, we'll be talking with Utah State University President Stan Albrecht. That follows the break.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan, now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Support for Utah Public Radio is also provided by the USU Huntsman School of Business, Partners in Business, the 38th Annual Operational Excellence Conference at the Eccles Conference Center, October 3rd and 4th, including keynote speaker Hiram Smith, Chairman and CEO of Legacy Quest Incorporated, the co-founder and former CEO Franklin Covey. Details at partners.usu.edu.
Life moves quickly in Utah's fastest-growing county, and as a member of Utah Public Radio's news team, I will keep you up to date on the latest news in Utah County. I'm Stephen Tanner, one of many reporters covering events happening in your neighborhood. For the latest in politics, science, arts, and religion, tune in to Utah Public Radio. Everything that matters to you matters to us. UPR, your favorite public radio station for statewide Utah news.
Support for Utah Public Radio is also provided by USU's offices of the Executive Vice President and Provost, the Center for Women and Gender hosting an evening with Mary Robinson, Reflections on Peace and Social Justice, October 10th at the Eccles Conference Center. Information is at usu.edu/womenandgender.
We conclude Access Utah now with a visit with Utah State University President Stan Albrecht on the occasion next week of the conclusion of USU's first comprehensive fundraising campaign. And President Albrecht, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So this is USU's first comprehensive campaign, and it's been quite the undertaking. When did it start?
But it is interesting. We're at 2012, and this is Utah State University's first ever comprehensive campaign. Mm-hmm. I know that over the years there have been plans, intentions to do campaigns. The stars have never quite aligned, and so shortly after I was appointed president, we knew going in that this was the time we needed to do a campaign, and so we announced the the formal start of the campaign about 6 months after I was appointed president, which is about 7 years ago. Mm.
And so you're concluding it next week with some a big event, I think.
We're having a big event. It's a celebration. It's deserving a celebration. You probably remember, Tom, that when we started the campaign, we announced a $200 million goal. We met and exceeded that goal in the first year of the campaign, which was really quite remarkable. We then announced that we were going to double the campaign, went into a difficult recession. The climb became just a bit steeper, but we will announce a number next Friday evening at our celebration, a week from Friday, at our celebration that is above the $400 million goal, and so we're excited. Mm.
That is incredible, especially in a recession. So what? Why do a comprehensive campaign? Why do institutions do this?
Well, again, if you look at the pattern, obviously private institutions have survived by doing this for many, many years, and so that tradition has been out there. They basically live on return from their endowment and student tuition, and public institutions have been able to rely more on public support, state support. But the pattern over a large number of years has been a loss of that state support. Our numbers continue to go down, and so we have simply had to find other ways to continue to move these institutions forward, and philanthropy becomes an increasingly important part of that.
And you've obviously found you hit a nerve. People wanted to support USU.
It's been really gratifying to see the level of caring that folks have for this institution. Many of our major gifts have come from those who have been associated with us for long periods of time. But we also have other very significant gifts that are from new donors. Some of them are alumni that we have gotten reconnected. Others of them had that direct of a connection to us. And so it's been really gratifying to see that happen.
What have people said? They, of course, some of them would have a connection to their alma mater. Others, I suppose, just want to support educational opportunities.
They want to support educational opportunities, but more specifically, they want to support the exciting things that are happening at this institution. And so we have just seen that happen again and again and again. And so it's a great compliment to Utah State University and the excellence that is Utah State University, that folks recognize that and want to participate in it.
What happens then to, I guess you would disperse the money from the return, the interest, yeah, right, and leave the corpus alone, but where does that money go?
Well, the money of course comes in many different forms. Money comes in to address specific projects and needs, and so a pretty significant amount of the money has come in to help us with facilities. We've built a significant number of new buildings, and so those gifts have gone to doing that. Other gifts have come in for programmatic support. Obviously, we have made a very significant step forward on the athletic front, and gifts have come in to help us with that. And so only a portion of the gifts really come in to the endowment. Mm. Our endowment has grown substantially, but we need to continue to grow that. So the endowment funds that are being generated from gifts to the endowment are largely concentrated in the scholarship arena. And so these become long-term commitments. They will fund hundreds of students today and thousands of students over a period of time. And so that's an important part of what has happened.
And in today's world, those scholarships are more and more needed, aren't they?
As
government money dries up.
Tuition goes up and government money dries up. It's really essential that we find other revenue streams to help us respond to the needs of our students.
What do you tell people as you go out? I guess we should emphasize that you can still give to USU even when...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We'll count it right up until we start the event from Friday.
That's right. There are some things that are unique about USU, and so people want to give specifically to USU because of those things. What are some of those things you talk about?
Well, just for example, we are so excited about the growth and success of our regional campus system, and we have significant gifts that have come in to help us build that. We in effect have a new campus in Vernal, and that campus is a result, first of all, of a wonderful land gift that was given to us, and then a gift from Mark and Debbie Bingham that allowed us to build the Bingham Entrepreneurship and Energy Research Center. And so many folks want to give to sort of the old land-grant concept of access and opportunity, and sometimes that's reflected in the regional campus system. Sometimes it's reflected in retention scholarships or legacy scholarships or Aggie Promise scholarships for first-generation students. Mm.
And what is the pitch to students? A lot of students have a choice. Many choose to come to USU. What are some of those reasons, do you think?
Well, again, We are unique. We are unique. We're the state's land-grant university. The 150th anniversary celebration this year of President Lincoln's signing of the Morrill Act. So it's a lot of the concept that is around the Morrill Act, the opportunity to come to a really good institution that cares deeply about sort of the public side of all that we do, access, opportunity, and so on. So students are attracted to that. But we also have this unique residential presence that in many ways is unlike many of our competitors, and so that sense of family. And you see that reflected at a football game Saturday where our students are there in mass, and it's you know, you have a much greater sense of identity with the institution and a much greater sense of family at a school that is residential and has the history and tradition that we have. Mm.
So there's a big event next week. I think it's the 12th,
right?
To wrap up this comprehensive campaign. Then it's kind of unfair to ask you this. In the glow of the comprehensive campaign's success, what are you on to? What are your worries after that?
Well, on the fundraising side is you don't have time to catch your breath. You simply need to go on, and we will go on. We won't announce a new campaign next Saturday morning, but. What we will do is we're meeting now to sort of talk about strategy for going forward, and we need to maintain the momentum, and so we'll announce ways that we intend to do that.
Mm. Very good. USU President Stan Albrecht announcing the successful completion of USU's first comprehensive fundraising campaign. The event is on October 12th. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
And we conclude the program now with a Steve Eaton commentary. Thanks for listening.
We're getting to that point in the presidential elections where some of the foolishness is set aside and we can get down to the serious business of picking our next leader.
Deseret News columnist Steve Eaton.
This is when we try to figure out who can best bring people together to work for the good of the country by pitting the two candidates, who are capable of raising and spending money the fastest, against each other. We ask them to get up on stage to demonstrate their leadership abilities by having them argue with and criticize each other before a live audience of millions. The presidential debates are upon us. Up until now, the election has been focused on seeing which candidate could go the longest without saying something that could be lifted out of context and called a gaffe. Now, instead, we'll be watching to see which candidate can go the longest in a debate without saying something that can be lifted out of context and called a gaffe. It's not that there hasn't been some serious campaigning. One of the candidates, and I won't say which one, has sent large, colorful, empty campaign buses around the country to help us decide who would be the best guardian of our money. I'm not naming names because I don't want the other guy to feel bad because he doesn't have as many empty buses available to him. But he shouldn't feel at a disadvantage. He has this cool plane with a bump on it that he borrowed from Harrison Ford and a fleet of black bulletproof cars. The bottom line is that both of these candidates want to connect with the average voters who struggle to make ends meet and let them know that they will care about them deeply until the election. And while holding campaign rallies where we're allowed to scream and praise at them and applaud them enthusiastically is one way to do that, I have a few new ideas I'd like to throw their way. Why not let some of us ride around in the buses? We had one stop in Logan recently, and there wasn't even a surrogate on it that I know about. If a crowd of hardworking Americans is willing to gather just to look upon a campaign bus and imagine a caring candidate inside of it, wouldn't it make sense to have a bunch of real people on the bus? You could have 10 or 20 people at a time taking turns getting off the bus and getting praised enthusiastically while connecting with the other average voters. The more articulate and creative bus riders could get off the bus and shout promises at the crowd to make them feel loved. If the crowds got too big, you could send a couple of campaign Cadillacs around the country too and have contests to see who could drive two of them at the same time. Or the other guy could take people on his airplane with him. We could convince him to do this by booting off the press and letting real people sit in the back. It would be a big party, and if anyone tried to get too serious or started to ask questions like the press always do, everyone could go downstairs and watch the candidate throw the offending people off his plane, like Harrison Ford did in Air Force One. We would give those who had literally fallen out of favor with the candidate colorful parachutes with campaign slogans on them and the promise that someone would eventually find them and feel their pain. But such talk is probably foolish at this point because the debates are what it's all about. And yet, while it may be disrespectful for me to suggest this, I think there are a few ways we could make them a bit more interesting. The use of a fire hose would change things quite a bit. What if the impartial fact-checkers the TV people employ were set up backstage and had the power to blast a candidate with a fire hose whenever he stretched the truth or misstated a fact? I'm not talking about a sustained blast that would force us to stop everything and go try to find the candidate, but just a short burst that would knock them on their fanny. Too extreme? How about arming each candidate with a bike horn? That way, instead of having to patiently wait, sighing heavily while the other candidate went on and on about you, you could presidentially honk your horn to drown him out. Then, sometime during the opening statements, the networks could make the debate scream into a little box of honkers, and we could watch regular network programming while we enjoyed the debates at the same time. It looks like the replacement refs are soon going to be out of work. What if we brought them in and let them call penalties on the candidates and gave them the power to keep score or, sadly, end the contest? A little humor wouldn't hurt things any. What if we could test out the candidates by rolling a football across the stage and letting them each dive on it to see who was best at recovering fumbles? The refs could then rule against the winner, and we could see how the candidates deal with an injustice. That might create some very entertaining gaffes, and we get to see Mitt Romney's hair all messed up. Of course, I believe a combination of all three ideas would work best. I know. I didn't build this campaign or our democracy. There are going to be some bumps on the road in an imperfect system. If they put me in charge, I'd probably just get fired by someone who likes to fire people, and then I'd end up being dependent on the government. Instead, I'll just sit back and watch them argue. Well, I'll have my own bike horn to keep me company, even though it's not my first choice. My wife has already warned me that, especially during the debates, garden hoses are not allowed in the house. This is Steve Eaton.
We'll see if any of that happens in the first presidential debate, which happens tomorrow evening at 7. You can hear that right here on Utah Public Radio, tomorrow evening, 7 o'clock. And another programming note, tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock on Access Utah, we're going to have several political types to talk about politics, but with a difference. We're going to check our partisan politics and fights at the door. We're going to focus on their foundational political beliefs. We're going to ask them, what are the ideas that motivate you in the political arena? With the understanding and belief that there are powerful and valid ideas in each political tradition. And so we'll have several prominent Utah political types, including Frank Pignanelli and LeVar Webb and Steve Urquhart and others. That's tomorrow. We'll ask the same questions of you. Thanks for listening today.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by USU's Huntsman School of Business, Partners in Business, the 38th Annual Operational Excellence Conference at the Eccles Conference Center, October 3rd and 4th, including keynote speaker Dustin Ott, Global Manager Operational Excellence, Boart Longyear. Details at partners.usu.edu.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan. KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.